So that last verse, verse 6, is our lead-in that leads us into verses 7 through 12. And so got the conspirators, they want to destroy him. So if somebody wants to start in there in 7 and read through 12, I'd appreciate it.
Jesus withdrew with his disciples to take the lake, and a large crowd from Galilee followed him. When they heard all he was doing, many people came to him from Judea, Jerusalem, Idumea, and their regions across the Jordan and around Tyre and Sidon. Because of the crowd, he told his disciples to have a small boat ready for him to keep the people from crowding him, for he had healed many, so that those with diseases were pushing forward to touch him. Whenever the evil spirits saw him, they fell down before him and cried out, "You are the Son of God." But he gave them strict orders not to tell who he was.
All right, thank you. Yeah, so after this event, Jesus withdrew to the sea. So what town was he in before that? Do you remember? Well, he was in Galilee, but that's the region. Where did he make his base in Galilee?
Capernaum.
And so Capernaum is right up on the north edge of the sea or big lake there. And so he went to the water's edge, apparently, is what he did. So he withdrew to the sea, and that wasn't a big trip. But his disciples and a great multitude of Galilee followed. So disciples, who are we talking about here? Well, we get a little bit of help, but not much, from the word. It's mathetes, which just means learners. So it does distinguish these people from the big multitude. How are they different than the multitude? What's the multitude after?
They want healing.
They want healing. You know, they want the benefits. They want, we don't have the free food going on here yet, but they want what Jesus is doing for them. It's pretty much geared toward the physical side of life. Healing. What's the other thing Jesus is doing a lot of?
Preaching.
Well, he's preaching, but casting out demons. So Jesus is exercising power in pretty fantastic ways. Now, we would say they were fantastic. We obviously are going to call them miracles, but the quantity is big. You're sick, you make contact with Jesus, it is extremely likely you're going to walk away restored. Okay? I mean, we don't know of any exceptions to that, because the word says, and he healed them all. So Jesus is making quite an impact on society. I don't know if I said that in this class or another setting, because I've been talking about this a couple other places, but in a sense, you did not want to be in the business, in the funeral home business at this time. Your traffic is going down. You're getting less customers because Jesus is out here healing people. So there could be a reduction in your business. Don't know that that happened, but that's the kind of situation that's going on. This is extreme. And so he withdrew his disciples. So now we get the disciples. They're different in this way. They're not the multitude pressing on him because of healing. They are following around because they want to learn. So there is a group that's distinguished among themselves because they're the learning group. And so they follow him as well as, and the words in the New American Standard are great multitude. So multitudes, a lot of people, not a number. It's just, this is a big crowd, you call it a multitude. Well, this is the biggest of the big crowds. This is a great multitude. So you've got a massive amount of people, and we're going to see more words that take us into that. But we want to focus a little bit more on that word disciples yet. There are some people we know are with him, don't we? Who do we know is with Jesus as the form of a disciple?
The 12.
Nope, Peter, not yet.
Peter, Andrew.
He's, right now he's called Peter or Simon and Andrew, brothers, right? There's another pair of brothers.
James and John.
Mark has recorded that he called them. And then he called another guy, Matthew. Now that's who Mark has talked about. If we start laying the Gospels one on top of another, Most would say, if we look at John's gospel, probably the first ones he called might have been Philip and Nathaniel. So at this point, he probably has 7 of the 12 identified. Certainly 5, because Mark has recorded it. But 7 of the 12 have been identified. He hasn't called them all yet. That happens to be what we'll talk about next week. But he's got at least those 7. So when it says disciples, is it just those 7? We don't know. It was at least those 7, because Jesus said, come follow me. This is a leader talking to his pupils. So we know they would be there. But there very well may have been a number of other people that were there because this guy's got something to say that I want to hear, I want to learn. They've recognized that he's more than just a miracle worker to do their bidding. Okay? And then we get this great multitude from Galilee, that's the big group. Oh, also Judea, and then from Jerusalem, and then Idumea, beyond the Jordan, and then the vicinity of Tyre and Sidon. And I messed up this morning. I had intentions and I forgot to do it. So if we drew ourselves a map, and I'm going to miss where Jerusalem is, okay? But somewhere down in here, this is the area of Judea, okay? And of course, Galilee's up here. And then I'm going to miss Tyre and Sidon, but they're along the coast. I'm just going to do this. Okay? And then you've got Idumea, which would be down over in here. And then you've also got, quote, beyond the Jordan. That's over in here. And so those turn out to be pretty interesting groups to have mentioned, particularly by name. So we know when we talk about Galilee, these folks up here in Galilee, this is Galilee here, it's mostly Jews, but there are some Gentiles up in there too, but it's a Jewish area. There's some Samaritans up there. They're not real popular folk. But you've got mostly Jews probably in that region. Jerusalem, that they call that out by name. Here's the capital. This is where the leaders are for the church, right? For the temple, right? For the Jewish faith. They're down there. So you got some people from Jerusalem. He's made a splash down there. And I don't mean to use flippant terms about it. He's made an impact. Because you know, how does Jesus start his ministry? What's the first thing he really does publicly?
When he gets baptized.
Well, that occurs, but the real thing he does with the general public...
Clears the temple.
Clears out the temple. Where does he do that? Well, the temple's in Jerusalem, right? So he started out with that. We're going to make more of that before we're done. And so he's already well known in Jerusalem. Oh, he went down there for the feast just before what we talked about happened in verses 1 through 6. So he's been down in Jerusalem for that, had a little bit of a conflict down there over healing. That probably preceded him back up into Galilee. So he's got some notoriety in Jerusalem. And then we get down in Idumea. Down in here, it's kind of considered part of Israel at this point. It's governed by the Romans and... But it's kind of a different spot than what we normally think of as Israel. But down in there, it's a mixture of Jews and Gentiles. Okay? And then we get beyond Jordan. Many people say this would be the land often called Perea, P-E-R-E-A. And once again, we've got a Jew-Gentile mix. We get over to Tyre and Sidon. This is the old Phoenician seafaring land, almost all Gentiles. You see what's happening? Jesus is getting a broad cross-section of that part of the country that goes well beyond just the Jews that are religious Jews. We're getting a lot of people drawn into this great number. And so here they are, this great crowd of people from really all the way around. You suppose the airlines and the trains were busy that week? Oh, wait a minute. We're going to get there on feet, either your feet or the feet of an animal, right? So feet's what gets you there. It's not an easy trip. And so he's got these people coming from all over. And why did they have that? Because the people had heard of all that he was doing. And what was he doing? We've already talked about that, the healing and the relief from demon possession. And you know, that's probably worth talking about just a minute. We've said it kind of before, but this is more, you know, if that happened today, would that be absolutely astounding? Sure. It would just be mind-boggling to have somebody around where if you had a physical malady, you could go to him and find yourself taken care of physically and come away restored, not just over the momentary disease and now you've got the recovery, but really restored. And it would be a big deal, but you'd have to multiply that many times over in this era, because they did not have the level of medical support, the understanding of the diseases and how they worked. I mean, today, before you'd go to the healer, you'd be over visiting with the pharmacy, right? You might be visiting with your doctor. I mean, there's a lot of places to go to try to get some relief and some comfort. But in this era, when you became ill, it was a big deal, because there wasn't a lot to do in many cases to help you out, and lifespans weren't terribly long. So that's what's going on. So it was really a big deal, and of course he's dealing with this demon possession as well. So when they get to the shore, what does he do? What does he tell his disciples?
Get a boat ready.
Have a boat ready. Why?
He's trying to stay away from that.
Well, he might need to get away from the crowd. And so Jesus says what we would call in the world I used to work in, a contingency plan. If this doesn't go right, what are we going to do? Well, if we get in there and we find out we've got this problem or that problem or that problem, we've already got a plan to deal with it. Well, here's Jesus planning ahead for some safety and for the ability to maintain that kind of a situation where the people don't completely overcome him by their closeness. So he said a boat should be ready. Now, this isn't just the generic term for boat. This, based on the way the language is constructed, it was a diminutive use of the word, so we know, get a small boat ready. A dinghy wouldn't be a bad way of saying it. And so he's going to have a small boat ready, because of the crowd, so that they would not crowd him, is what the New American Standard says. Anybody else have any other translations on would not crowd him?
Crush him.
Crush him. Yeah, literally it says fall on him. Mm-hmm. So why would they be trying to get so close?
Because he could touch them.
So they could touch him.
Right.
Or he could touch them, because often the healing was by touch. And often, people, all they had to do was touch Jesus. You remember that Jesus had an encounter in a different gospel, or at least in a different time than this, after this, with the Phoenician, I believe it's a Phoenician woman. Do I have it right?
Yeah.
But anyway, she touched the hem of his garment. And Jesus turned because she believed that she would be healed just by touching the hem of his garment. And so he said, "Who touched me?" And she indeed was healed. He withheld it for a little bit so he could do some teaching there. But that was what was happening. People would come in contact with him. They would be healed. And so here they were in verse 10 saying that for he had healed many, with the result that all those who had afflictions pressed around him in order to touch him. So they're trying to get up close and get their hands on Jesus, with the hope and belief that if they can do that, he's going to be healing them. And you can imagine now, if you had 10 people all trying to touch you at the same time, you probably could, it might look a little bit like one of the football games from yesterday, but you're probably going to make out all right, okay? But now we're talking about thousands, hundreds of thousands, I don't know how many, but thousands at least of people that are there. If they're coming from that far around, a great multitude, and here they all are. The guy at the outside edge wants to touch you. So what's going to happen? Pushing. And after a while, you know, that's how people get trampled. You know, there have been numerous cases of things happen at big events and people want to get from point A to point B, either for a good reason or a bad one. And the people in that path get trampled because of the crowd. We're just going right over the top of them. So Jesus is recognizing that, and he's trying to keep that in order. Now, there's nothing in here that says he ever got in the boat. And how's that small boat going to help him?
Well, it's going to get away from ground.
Yeah, just get a little distance from the shore.
Sure.
He can still interact with them. As a matter of fact, he does teaching out of a boat in other situations. So he's got this boat ready. Who knows if it was just him going to be in the boat or him and the disciples or whatever. Depends on how big that group was, right? So they pressed around him in order to touch him. And it said, this is an interesting statement. Whenever the unclean spirits saw him, they would fall down before him and shout, "You are the Son of God." And that's worth talking about for just a moment. We already have dealt with one demon possession, right? What did that... Well, I think you could go back to chapter 1, verse 23. How did that unclean spirit respond?
About the same way.
Yeah, there's a little bit different detail.
Said, did you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One.
Yeah, the word I'm going to focus on is cried out. I don't know if you remember or not, but really that could correctly be translated screamed. So when these unclean spirits come into the presence of Jesus, they're falling down before him. So now what do you think Mark is describing here?
They're afraid.
What?
Submission to his authority.
Submission to his authority. Well, the unclean spirit's in a person, right? When I look at this, I think this person is down. They're not standing up and being bold. They're in a position showing that they're falling down before Jesus. So I think the person is responding in that way. The spirit certainly is responding in that way. They're humbling themselves in front of Jesus. Now they're yelling out, "You are the Son of God." Now, does that sound like good strategy on the part of the spirits? I mean, what would you think is the typical pattern of most of these unclean spirits? They want to remain incognito, don't they? Don't they want to be able to work in the back world? I mean, don't they like darkness rather than light? Yeah. Now they like to masquerade. Satan likes to masquerade as a being of light, but here they are. It's just kind of it's an interesting thing that they're just voicing themselves. Yes, sir.
Well, I guess the idea, as far as people would go, that would be true. But as far as the light is there, so they have no choice but to.
The light shining on them. Yeah.
And it's not a matter of them submitting themselves. Here's a sword over their head. Even though they don't want to submit themselves, the sword is theirs.
Yeah, look, go over and somebody read James 2:19. Very, very common verse. We use it a lot. It's in the context of James talking about what it means to have faith.
You believe that there is one God, you do well. Even the demons believe that and tremble.
So the demons aren't comfortable. They believe in Jesus. They believe in God. But it's not a comfortable situation for them to believe in. I mean, it's kind of like saying to the person on death row, "Do you believe in the executioner?" Yeah, can we talk about something else? I mean, that it isn't a comfortable topic. But here are these demons screaming out, and Jesus warned them what? Don't tell people who I am. He didn't want the testimony of the demons to be central to recognizing who he was. So, we've kind of worked our way through this passage and we're seeing the events, but we probably need to see them with just a little bit more of the context of the time that this is occurring, because we talked about illness a little bit, and certainly illness, being ill, and we ought to talk about the word for that. The word there that they use is... in the New American Standard, oh, can't see it all of a sudden. Oh, I'm looking in the wrong spot. all those who had afflictions pressed around him. That word afflictions, if you go back and look at it, it really means were scourged, whipped. Now, the way the word's used in the New Testament and the way it's constructed here, we know they're talking about physical illness, but this fits the context of how people understood being ill, having a sickness. The sickness came because of your behaviors in life. You're going to get sick because you're a sinner. Remember what they asked about the man born blind? Well, whose sin was this, him or his parents? I mean, there was a connection between sin in their minds and being ill. And isn't that illustrative of what Jesus is doing? I mean, it's almost like, and it's a stretch from it, but it borders on the issue of healing people, of forgiving people their sins. If people view this malady upon them, and they, it's to be whipped, it's their punishment. I'm ill because of something in my life. Jesus comes along and heals you. Kind of takes care of both sides of that, doesn't it? I no longer am ill.
In the case of the Egyptians, he sent plagues upon them. So
yeah, I mean, God does do that, right? Even Paul said regarding the way people were handling their time of communion. Some of you are ill and some of you are even asleep because of your mishandling of your attitude, the way you conduct yourself in this time of communion. What did he mean? Some people have been put to death by God himself for the way they were inappropriately handling themselves during communion. So God can and does do that, but it's much of the illness in life doesn't come there. What was Jesus' answer about the man born blind? Who sinned? Neither. The man was born blind so that the purposes of God could be accomplished and Jesus could be revealed. So that's a little bit of what's going on in all of this. Now, Jesus has this group over here that are conspiring to kill him, right? And at the same time, he's got these huge crowds coming around because they are after healing and maybe relief from demon possession. So these folks over here that are trying to kill him, how did they counteract what's going on with Jesus doing this healing?
Can you have, I don't understand the question.
And you may not, because I'm kind of trying to ask a trick question.
Okay.
So what did they do about Jesus' healing?
What did they say? The demons, he was a devil.
With regard to the demons, they tried to say, okay, you're doing this by the power of Satan. What did they say about his healing? And the answer is really nothing. I mean, to the point of even, they knew this man that had the withered hand. This wasn't in the previous, what we studied last week. This wasn't a man that came out of nowhere. He's in this community. People knew him. They knew the man with the withered hand was going to be in the synagogue. And they set things up to have themselves there so they could see what happened when Jesus encountered them. Expecting what? Not only that he would heal him, but that he could. Do you see what's happening here? When these folks want to destroy Jesus, it isn't because they think he's a fraud.
No, I know he's not.
Matter of fact, they know he's not a fraud. Do they believe in Jesus' ability to do these healings?
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Do they believe in his ability to cast out the demons? See, they didn't say you're a fraud, you really didn't cast the demon out. The only thing they could do is say, no, you're really not doing this with the power of God. So, if they don't think Jesus is a fraud, why are they not joining the crowd?
He's a threat to their hegemony, their establishment.
Well, it goes even further than that. He is a threat, absolutely. Yes.
Maybe they're the evil spirits.
Yeah, well, I don't think there's much doubt some of them were directed by Satan to a point. Now, to be fair, you got to understand that the practices of Judaism in Jerusalem and in the land of Israel have been going on for a long time in the way that Jesus found them. And there were problems with them. I think even the people knew they got ripped off when they went in to trade their sheep that they found a flaw with. They had to spend a lot of money to get a different sheep. I think they probably knew in their back of their minds, this is a fraud and a ripoff, but what am I going to do? I've got to go to God. I've got to present the priest with the sheep. And so they're doing all this religious function. And maybe when they kind of pull the curtain back and know it's not just right, they still don't have a better alternative. And so this is deeply embedded in who they are and what they do and how they've been doing it, how they view life. As a matter of fact, we talk about sickness being lined up with a belief that it comes from sin. When you became ill, you're probably going to find yourself out of the synagogue. They don't want you around. And it isn't because they're smart enough to know you're contagious. They don't want you around because you're a sinner. And you might not be involved in social events. You might even be put out of your family. Certainly that occurred if your illness was something like leprosy. But just other illnesses as well were sometimes treated that way. And so these are you know, it's just ingrained in who they are. So to be fair with them about that. But did Jesus come to fix what was wrong with their worship in Jerusalem in the temple?
No.
Go back to what Thad taught when I wasn't here. Chapter 2, 21 and 22. Let's read that again.
No one sews a patch of unshrunk cloth on an old garment. Otherwise, the patch pulls away from it, the new from the old, and a worse tear results. And no one puts new wine into old wineskins. Otherwise, the wine will burst the skins, and the wine is lost, and the skins as well. But one puts new wine into fresh wineskins.
Okay. So what's the point of what Jesus told him there?
You can't mix the old with the new.
Can't mix the old with the new. And Jesus is the?
New.
And the old is? Judaism, whatever you want to call it. The Jewish temple worship as they were used to doing it. And as a matter of fact, when Jesus started his public ministry, go over to John chapter 1. Let's read that, 13 through 22. What did I do wrong? It's not John chapter 1. There's water into the wine. Okay, I must have the wrong book. I don't know. So let me tell you what I know is in that I was going to draw out. This was supposed to be the passage where Jesus cleared out the temple. And it's interesting that when he did that, what's that?
2:13.
That's what I got off. Let's read that. 2:13 to 22. Crossing lines up now.
The Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. In the temple, he found those who were selling oxen and sheep and pigeons, and the money changers sitting there. And making a whip of cords, he drove them all out of the temple with the sheep and oxen. And he poured out the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. And he told those who sold the pigeons, "Take these things away. Do not make my father's house a house of trade." His disciples remembered that it was written, "Zeal for your house will consume me." So the Jews said to him, "What sign do you show us for doing these things?" Jesus answered them, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." Then the Jews said, "It has taken 46 years to build this temple, and will you raise it up in 3 days?" But he was speaking about the temple of his body.
Okay. So when Jesus did this, who did he drive out?
Money changers.
The money changers?
And the oxen.
The oxen, the sheep.
Everything.
The people. What was left in the temple? Now, let's realize, where did this occur? What are the three main parts of the temple?
Holy of Holies.
Holy of Holies. The holy place.
The Gentile court.
The Gentile court. And it's this outer court that was really very large that they would do all this interchange. They weren't in the worship area where they actually made the sacrifices. So we don't know really what went on in there. You can bet that the people that were in there, that's going to include priests and whatever, did they just, oh, I wonder what's going on out there? That's sure noisy. No, they were going to go out and see what's going on. But when they got done, who was left in this inner court? Probably just Jesus. He drove them all out. Now, Passover. We talked when we went through the book of John about how many people were probably there. Do you remember? Now, I don't mean in that outer court, but in Jerusalem for the Passover. Between 1 and 2 million people probably arrived in Jerusalem, and collectively with the people in Jerusalem. That's probably about how big of an event it was. And the Passover week was the big week, right? So was it crowded in here? Yes. So Jesus drives them all out. What's happened to the Passover activities?
Stopped.
I mean, it wasn't just that he got rid of the money changing, but the money changing was going on so people had the sacrifices to make. I mean, he stopped temple worship as they knew it in Passover week. And even if you want to go outside of this courtyard, there's a lot of people out there that came to worship, right? Do you suppose they were happy with this? Jesus stared down. I mean, it'd be no different than stopping a Super Bowl. Really. Jesus stared down through his presence and a cord of ropes. He stared down the entire Jewish community that was there to celebrate the Passover and stopped it. Yes, sir.
I just said, in the Old Testament, there are several places where God had basically told the Jews that their sacrifices and stuff were a waste of time.
Yes, absolutely. So here's Jesus. He stopped it. Is Jesus' message to them is, hey, guys, you're not quite doing this right. Let's see if we can fix it up and start doing this in a way that honors God. No, from the very beginning of his public ministry, it was, this is not acceptable. It's coming to an end. God is done with you. You can join his heavenly kingdom. If you want to, you're going to have to be born again. I mean, the whole message of Christ is kind of encapsulated when he stops the Jewish worship. When we taught through the book of John, I was just amazed. I hadn't realized it. I knew there was this contention between Jesus and the Jewish leadership. And I always thought that it was because they just didn't get it. No. If you read John, why were they mad at Jesus? Because they understood him. That's when they got mad, is when he said something, they clearly got it. As we're going through Mark, what I'm beginning to see is, when it comes, because that was about his teaching in John, we get to Mark, we talk about all these miracles. They want to kill Jesus, not because they thought he was a fraud, but because they knew he wasn't. They knew they were face to face with a power that was mightier than they were and the religion that they were practicing. They didn't like it. They knew that Jesus wasn't there to fix it. He was there to stop it. And so they begin to figure out how to destroy him. Because frankly, if you're going to be a leader in the Jewish faith, if you let Jesus hang around, your job's over. It's not going to continue. That becomes pretty obvious. Look at the size of the crowd all over the Middle East. Everybody's coming to him because not only do they want to be healed, they will be healed. And so they can't call him a fraud and put him away. They try at a different point in time to say, well, this demon stuff, you're doing it by the power of demons, and they try that, doesn't work. So they really only have one choice if they don't want what they've been a part of to just stop. But as a matter of fact, there will come a time when Jesus says, not one stone's going to be left on another. And we know the destruction of Jerusalem happens in AD 70. Since that time, has there been a sacrifice? Have there been priests? It stopped. And that's what he tells them is going to happen. But in this case, we're not to that point yet. The point I wanted to make out of this part of it is that Jesus doesn't come and say, let's take who you are and kind of shape your edges more correctly. When we had the Reformation happen in the church, we have the Dark Ages, and then we have the Martin Luthers and the Calvins and whomever gets involved, and we see a return to God's Word, a growth of the truth instead of a lot of other funky things, and they basically look at Christianity and say, we're missing it. The Catholic Church is called out by Martin Luther, for an example, and a big part of it was the selling of indulgences, and he calls out and says, this isn't right. And the church gets called out. That was a time when God, through some men, and they weren't perfect men, they had some of their issues too that we've had to work on since then, but God begins to restore his church and bring about a correction in the church. That's far different. That's not even in the same league as what Jesus does here. He stops Judaism as something that people could recognize as a way, as a path to God, as the way they practiced it. And even practicing Jews today, we don't have temple worship, we don't have the things that surrounded it in that time. Which I guess is a good way to lead to the conclusion out of this. We have the same thing facing us, don't we? We don't get to just take our rough person and let Jesus smooth up the edges and make us a nice person. We don't start out evil, doing some bad things along with some things others would call good, and if Jesus comes along and says, we just need to take care of this and that, or we don't take some bad beliefs and just fix them up and say, well, okay, you know, now you're fine. What has to happen for us to be in the kingdom of God is we have to be what?
Born again.
And that rebirth then is a new heart and a new mind. Everything, the old is passed away, everything becomes new. And that's absolutely what's required, and this is probably a good model for that. Questions, comments, thoughts?
The basic theology is man against God. That's never changed. It always boils down to the same thing, only a little bit different form.
Yeah, and God's opposed to the proud and gives grace to the humble. You are not going to be born again and stay proud. You're going to be born again when you say, I'm helpless, I'm depraved, I'm a gross sinner, I can't fix it. God, I need your mercy and your grace. And that's the way it works.
John MacArthur's sermon, I found that interesting when you were talking about the temple. Because he said he needs to change how he refers to that. Because he has often said it's a cleansing of the temple.
Yeah, it really did. It wasn't a cleansing. No. It was a... There are two temporary shutdowns before the permanent one comes in AD 70. Jesus starts his ministry with it, and he ends his ministry with it.
As one guy put it...
His public ministry.
Jesus was a Judean, but he was not Jewish, as far as the religion goes.
Well, as far as the religion as they were practicing, as far as what God intended... He not only was, he fulfilled it and was perfect at it.
Right. So they never really practiced it.
Because he came not to abolish the law, but to fulfill it. Right. And so he did. But they weren't going to accept that because they had received a lot of rules and that weren't from God, and they were asking the people to follow them.
And as we looked at with the new and old wineskins, that extra detail from Luke that I had not seen before, where he finishes out, and no one after drinking old wine wishes for new, for he says the old is good enough. Yep. That's the Pharisees.
It's an interesting thing, though, all the way through the Old Testament, time and time again, he says, I am calling out a remnant. So the old wineskin, in a sense, was the Jewish perversion, because the new wineskin had always been there.
Well, God's always had a remnant and always will have a remnant. So, yeah, that's right. Any other questions or comments?
So we've talked about this before, how if you were sick, mm-hmm. they attributed that to sin. Mm-hmm. Is that because in the Old Testament that...
Well, why is a hard question to answer?
Okay.
Because there were lots of inputs. You have the inputs of the leadership, who definitely saw prosperity and good things happening to you in life as a pat on the back from God. So the more money I have and the better things are going in my life, that gets a source of pride. Okay? So you've got the Jewish leaders that were reinforcing that. You can go read in the Old Testament that, you know, some of this is going to happen. You can go read in the Old Testament some of that did happen and undoubtedly still happens today. But you can't go to a person's situation in life and start saying, I know this is because of sin. When we pray as elders with people who are sick, if you go look at what James says to do, you know, he says, anoint your head with oil and so on, and encourages confessing of sin. So we ask people, you know, is there some sin you need to confess? I mean, we don't know, even if you have a sin in your life that you're hiding, that you're not dealing with, that you haven't repented from, that still might not mean that there's a connection between that and the sickness. But we give people the opportunity that if they know something to clear that out, so that if that is connected, they can be put on the right path. And so it's that kind of a thing is the right place to hit. But we don't know why did they do it. It was their heritage. You could read the Old Testament, maybe pick it up. I mean, there's lots of reasons why people will think that. And even today, the health and wealth gospel that's out there, God wants you to be healthy and he wants you to be well. Are you ever going to die? Well, I mean, that's what I want to ask these guys. So nobody in your congregation that's really a believer ever gets sick? You know, they only die by accident? Well, wouldn't that be a curse of God too? I mean, so anyway, I mean, we just have a lot of it in our world today. A lot of it.
In every lie, there's a grain of truth, and the truth is, yes, all that sickness comes from sin.
Well, ultimately, it comes from sin of the fall.
Yeah.
I mean, before the fall, that wasn't going to be a problem. But, I wonder, this is going to sound bad, and I don't mean it quite the way I sound, but I just wonder what medicinal powers was in the tree of life, because that God said, we're going to take that away so they don't live forever. Well, it must have been some really powerful medicine in there.
Yeah.
But anyway, the fall came, we get sick, we die. Pointed for man wants to die. There'll be a small group, obviously, that when the rapture occurs, we'll miss that moment. But other than that, and there's two guys in the Old Testament that didn't occur, Elijah and Enoch didn't die. And that's why many think that's the identity of the two that will be the two witnesses in Jerusalem in the end times, because their time still is yet to come, because they are killed. Remember, if you look at the two witnesses, some people think that. I don't think it really matters. God can do it however he wants. And of course, those two, then they lay dead in the streets and the whole world sees them, and then they live again. That ought to be an exciting moment. But it'll be just like here. Many of those people will see, and they'll know it. They won't argue with it, but they're going to reject it. So, any other questions or comments? Well, sometimes it's a challenge to hit the right amount of material for the morning so that the timing all works out. We didn't do too bad, but anyway, that's what I have this morning. Yes, sir?
Yeah, it says, whenever the evil spirits saw him, they fell down before him and cried out. Are these evil spirits, are they actually the fallen angels?
They are. Absolutely they are. The kind of the thing that you find in heaven is when Satan was originally an angel, and he was the prince of angels, I mean, greater than any other. I mean, he was the beautiful angel, the smart angel, the whatever. He was seen as top of the heap, and he became caught up with himself, and he rebelled against God. He wanted to be equal with God, and he and a third of the angels in heaven went with him in a rebellion. And so God has treated them as enemies. We know what their ultimate fate is. They're going to go in the lake of fire. God lets them disrupt this world a bit. It started in the Garden of Eden. That was Satan encouraging Eve with some lies to sin. But yes, that's who those folks are. They're the demons. They're the fallen angels. And they are occasionally found embedded in people's lives as a big influence. Yes, ma'am.
And I guess when I was saying earlier that they were submitting themselves to his authority, there's a difference between willful submission.
Oh, yeah.
And
they didn't want to.
Just submission.
Yeah, they didn't have any choice.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just they have known since the time of their fall, the satanic fall, not
human fall.
Excuse me, the human falling. They've known since that time their ultimate fate, and it's just a matter of time until God exercises that.
Well, and I guess more than likely, this is the first time they've seen Christ since their rebellion, so it may be a reckoning is here right now, and that's why they're falling down.
Well, as a matter of fact, they asked that question. So I think that's what they think. That's one of the questions. Have you, is that why you're here? And Jesus says, shut up. That's all he says. Shut up. Which, by the way, is what Paul does.
Yeah.
You know, Paul had the ability to tell him to shut up. And what we need to do, if we encounter something where we think there's a demon involved, we don't need to be talking to him. We don't need to be interacting with him. We need to be praying. Because we don't have that same situation that those apostles had, where they could cast out demons and deal with that. We instead need to turn to the one who does. Christ is still alive and well, right? And so that's how we need to be responding if we are suspicious that that's what's going on.
And again, what a contrast between the demons who are saying you are the Son of God and the Pharisees.
Yeah. I mean, does it put them in a better place? No.
No.
But, you know, that's kind of what James is saying, too, when he says the demons believe and shudder. You know, recognizing who Jesus is isn't the same as embracing and endorsing him in this world and in your own life.
So was there more activity of demon possession?
You know, I don't know how to know that or answer that. The thing that I would say is you don't really see it in the Old Testament. You see it at this moment when Christ is walking around on the earth. And even as the apostles are about their business and the things they write about, if demon possession was going to be the crisis and for the believers to deal with, they would be talking about it. And so there's a few cases where you see something happen after Christ's ascension. But just not very much. So my sense of it is that the level of activity peaked in an enormous way when Jesus was here. I don't know that I could say that and say I know I'm right. That's just my sense of it based on what I see in the New Testament. Any other questions? All right, well, let's close with prayer. Lord, thank you. Thank you for coming to this earth. Thank you for being clear with both your actions and your words what your kingdom was about. Lord, thank you for making it clear to us that if we want to be in your kingdom, we must be born again. And we thank you for Paul's words that if we are born again, the old has passed away and everything has become new. Lord, let us focus on the newness of our life and the newness of what it means to be born again and just live out that rebirth. Lord, at the same time, let us recognize what's involved with people who deny you. Lord, it isn't that the Pharisees didn't believe, they just weren't willing to believe. They believed the miracles, they weren't willing to believe that your lordship over their lives would be better than what they had where they were in charge. Lord, let us be very tender and gracious with the people that don't know you, but let us be very clear about who you are and what you offer when we bring our testimony to the gospel of Christ. It's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.